did a whole gene sequence and found that they have a missing protein on their white blood cells, which HIV uses to sneak into the white blood cells and disrupt our immune function. So just not having it means that their immune function won't be disrupted, but is it possible that they might have a subacute episode of HIV virus and be carriers? Yeah, I guess so, which is, again, a consequence which a lot of people don't take the time to think about too much.
That's all I have. Go ahead.
Okay, Lou, anyone else with any comments, questions, or statements?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'll send you an email, and then what will be on it will be the link to the 60 Minutes show. You know, just bring up that clip. It's a 14-minute piece. It's on back in April 29th of this year. So once once anybody brings it up and they click on that first the first video for 60 Minutes, they'll get whole topic that they ran back.
Okay, very good, Paul, I'll probably post it on the webpage as well. And for anyone who really desperately wants to know what CRISPR stands for, not that it's going to really add to any kind of sense that any of us know exactly what these mad scientists are doing. It stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. So it's not really very descriptive for the technique used.
That's the first thing they say on 60 Minutes when they introduce that piece.
I have the impression, Roy, that the genetic modification and the final result of it is so complicated that for any reasonable length of time there may never be a computer program, procedure, or whatever that can predict all the possible results of a modification. As such, the only way you're going to really find out what happens is to do the experiment. And when we do the experiment on human beings, we run into a serious ethics problem. I am going to make a guess that some further experiments are going to take place, but because of the ethics implications, the people doing those experiments are going to keep quiet about what they're doing until they're on their deathbed. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
Well, given the lesson from this Chinese doctor who experimented without approval in authoritarian People's Republic of China, I think that would be a wise conclusion for these people. Now, how exactly they get funding, probably through fraud, is another problem that has to be addressed. But yeah, I think most of the guys out there have learned a very serious lesson. If you're not doing something that's legal, do not go to a seminar and announce it to the world.
Sounds to me like they announced it to the world because they had a false sense of security that what they thought what they did was so good and that the chances of it being bad were so low that they felt free to announce it and claim credit. They didn't realize how human nature would respond to this new so-called breakthrough of
Heroic. It's just another example of the sin of hubris, which goes back to Greek tragedies and probably before people wrote down tragedies or comedies, that people lived lives of hubris. Just thinking that he was cleverer than the rest of them and he got away with something. And those guys in China don't really like that.
Is there anybody anywhere in the world that right now likes it?
If there are guys who love Jar Jar Binks. There's always going to be outliers, and there's outliers for geneticists and ethicists who think that this is okay. It's for science. It's for knowledge. It's HIV prevention. And they basically go along with it. So you'll always find guys who go along with anything and everything. It's the nature of humanity. It's a bell-shaped curve.
2OAS. Mark? Roger that. So what I say is this. Do an experiment you want on yourself, but leave everybody else out of it. There's nothing that would be mandatory to do this.
Well, you might make a case for that on certain levels, but again, ethicists would suggest that being your own guinea pig is ill-advised also. There are cases of people who did that and succeeded and triumphed. The gentleman who detected H. pylori as a bacterial infection in the stomach gut that produces a significant number of human cases of ulcers. Could not possibly get experimentation funds. So, unfortunately or fortunately, he infected himself with H. pylori, developed a severe case of ulcers, and sort of proved his theory that way. But for each time that that happens, well, at least there's a lot of very bad or very good science fiction that shows the poor guy turning into a terrible, terrible problem. The Invisible Man was a wonderful case of supposedly of a scientist who experimented on himself, and so was Jekyll and Hyde. That was another great story. So, although some ethicists would tell you that, yeah, you can't, as long as you do it to yourself, you know, who cares? But in society, we do care. We care if someone commits suicide, we care a great deal. So, it depends on your sense of ethics and morality, unfortunately.
Roger that. Well, I don't believe in Darwin, so I believe in God, and that's where I lay.
God bless America. You are free to believe in anything that you wish to believe as long as you do not do anything against another person for any of those beliefs.
Roger that. That's what I was saying. Anything mandatory and anybody that doesn't want to, I understand. President knows a lot of stuff that he knows that they have old cures, wants to allow experimental treatments. Fine. So if you want to have an experimental treatment, you have a disease and you want to try something, good, that's up to you. But don't force things on everybody else to change their genetics if they won't get this disease, whatever it may be. That's my point.
Okay, Mark, perfectly understood, and as I repeatedly tell people, anyone interested in further discussions on the subject, at 12:05, the repeater is going to have the politics net, and you're free to discuss it in minute detail. Otherwise, if anyone has any further comments, statements, what have you on the subject, please speak now, or I'll move on to the next little article.
Unrelated question.
Okay, Wesley, what's your unrelated question?
To exchange. In the last TechNet, I think we're talking about transmission lines, and there are two of them, microstrip and line. And there is a slight difference between them, and they operate with TEM. And TM has two subgroups, which is T and TM. And I wanted just to say that it cannot exist without dielectric, that I was asking for the dielectric. Do you agree with that?
The dielectric is the air. In other words, in the case of either microstrip or strip line, as long as you've got some other auxiliary method of suspending that center conductor, the dielectric could be air or vacuum. If it's vacuum, technically that is a kind of dielectric, although under normal vocabulary, there really isn't anything there, material there, that you and I would call dielectric. It'll work like a charm. Over to you, Wes.
Well, a strip line is TEM, transverse electromagnetic transmission line media, and it exists in quarks. And the filling factor for quarks is unity. The GF equals here, if I remember correctly. That means it's not dispersive. Circuits made as microstrip requires solid dielectric the dielectric constant of the air is 1. By that, microchip cannot exist without dielectric. And Tracy?
I have used microstrip and I have used strip line, both of which had nothing but air as the dielectric, and they worked like a charm. So when you said it couldn't exist, I don't agree. I've done it, I've seen it. Most dielectrics will have a slight change in velocity factor or dielectric constant as a function of frequency. Therefore, to some degree, every one of these transmission lines is slightly dispersive. And you could, if you're going to get into the fine nitty-gritty, even with vacuum as a dielectric, because of the skin depth phenomenon, which changes the function of frequency, to a small degree, even a vacuum dielectric material is still going to be slightly dispersive. So depending on how finely you define it, every transmission line has a degree of dispersion. In other words, a slight change in velocity factor as a function of frequency.
This is true for strip line. However, microstrip use quasi TEM, which is TE and TM. They're actually flat. That exists only in the boundary between the electric and the conducting platform. Doesn't appear to be any else. And to actually,
you seem to be saying strip line. By the way, strip line has an upper ground plane, lower ground plane, and a center conductor that's usually a flat strip. And you're saying that cannot be dispersive. It certainly can. There are certain dielectric materials I can use where the dielectric constant changes as a function of frequency. That will force it to be dispersive. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
I was talking about microstrip. There is a difference between strip line and a microstrip, and I would love if you explain to me.
If I take strip line, which has an upper ground plane and a lower ground plane and a center conductor, and dielectric materials usually in between, that's strip line, full biplanar strip line. If I remove the upper ground plane, characteristic impedance will go up higher, but I now have strip line. So there's a strong relationship between strip line and microstrip. I now have microstrip, is what I'm saying, when I remove the upper ground plane. Even with the upper ground plane gone, the dielectric material that's suspending that center conductor above the lower ground plane can still be a material that changes in dielectric constant as a function of frequency and will be dispersive. To some degree, every transmission line you and I can discuss, even open wire line, to some degree, is dispersive. Over to you, K2RIW.
So I understood the strip line is a conductor switched sandwich by dielectric between a pair of ground planes, much like a coax. Okay? So what is the, then, if we're talking about the strip line, microstrip, what is microstrip?
Microstrip is strip line with the upper ground plane removed. Over to you.
And the microstrip doesn't work without dielectric. So the T in the mode, it travels in the interface. Am I right or wrong?
I can generate microstrip with no dielectric material other than vacuum, and it will work like a charm. How I suspend that semiconductor is a little bit spooky. Maybe I can do it in a zero-G environment, a microgravity environment. The dielectric material is a convenient construction technique. You can definitely make microstrip with no dielectric material. It still is a transmission line. It can have very high performance. Over to you, Wes.
In waveguide, we have a number of modes. And we can have a different format which electromagnetic wave can propagate within the waveguide. And those are TE mode. The waveguide mode is dependent upon the transverse electric wave. And sometimes it is called H waves, characterized by the fact that the electric vector E being always perpendicular to the direction of the propagation. And the TM mode, transverse magnetic mode, is a transverse magnetic wave. They call it E waves, characterized by the fact that the magnetic vector H is always perpendicular to the direction of propagation, which application then those modes have in the waveguide. And to achieve.
If I had my piece of waveguide with the broad surface laying flat on the table, the wave going down that waveguide above at the right frequency is bouncing back and forth between the left and right vertical walls, we call that the TE wave. If the wave is at a slightly higher frequency and bouncing up and down across the flat walls, the broad walls, we call that the TM mode. Combine TE and TM. The bottom line is every kind of transmission line that has ever been invented, you give me a high enough frequency and a method of launching the wave, I can launch other modes of propagation at different velocity factors down that transmission line. So there isn't a brand new law of physics just because I've got waveguide versus microstrip versus strip line versus open wire line versus thin line. There's 15 kinds of transmission line. Every one of them, you give me a high enough frequency, I will give you other modes of propagation. So what are we saying here, Wes? K2LIW?
How about the lower frequency limit? For each waveguide mode, there is a definite lower frequency limit. What that limit is determined by?
When the wave that you're putting down the waveguide is greater than half wave of the real width of the guide, you're at or below the cutoff frequency, and no real propagation takes place. Every frequency you put down a piece of waveguide, let me drop it. Depending on the frequency you're at and the dimensions of the guide, every wave you put down a piece of waveguide has an extremely specific angle of bounce. Signal is bouncing left and right across the narrow walls for TE wave. It has a very specific angle of every single bounce. No other angle is allowed for that frequency. As you go to lower and lower frequencies, the angle of the bounce becomes closer and closer to 90 degrees. When the angle of the bounce becomes exactly 90 degrees, there is no forward propagation, and we call that cutoff. And for lower frequencies than that, where the wavelength is bigger than half wave for that dimension, no real propagation takes place. It is now an extreme attenuator instead of a propagator. Once you understand what's going on, there isn't any real magic there. And I think it's time we go back to Roy, because we've gone very far left of center here, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Just one more thing. There are many modes in the waveguides in a higher frequency, precise frequency of the frequency. How many modes do we have with the lowest possible frequencies? Intuition.
When you go below a frequency low enough where the dimension is of the guide is less than a half wave, there are no modes anymore. There is no real propagation. There's nothing but attenuation. You go to high enough frequencies, there's an infinite number of modes. Let's go back to Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, Doug. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Wes. We were talking about genetics. So, let's see. It is believed that mitochondria began originally as a kind of bacteria that evolved the very useful ability to more efficiently extract energy out of organic molecules using all that cheap and readily available oxygen that had been poisoning the atmosphere of the Earth by those newfangled chlorophyll-based biological solar power generators that plant life had evolved into being. Prior to that, the Earth had been covered by only anaerobic organisms, who best in an oxygen-poor environment. Now, the idea is that once upon a time, a bigger one-celled organism swallowed one of those proto-mitochondrial whole, as they did many other single-celled organisms, before digesting them for raw materials and high-energy organic molecules. Except for this time, for some reason, the larger single-celled organism couldn't digest the proto-mitochondria, it might have ended there with the proto mitochondria coexisting as a parasite to its host. It's happened before and it'll happen again, but this time these two organisms had a symbiotic relationship that wasn't all one way. As with parasites, it was an advantageous association to both organisms, referred to as mutualism, and thus was formed a beautiful friendship that has continued for more than a billion years. Let me drop for a second. Okay, over the eons, much this proto-mitochondria's genetic material was moved over to the DNA in the cell's nucleus. But there still remains an appreciable amount of DNA for the mitochondria still residing inside each and every mitochondrion in your body. Now, geneticists will tell you that every single one of your mitochondrial DNAs was inherited from your mother. Your father's sperm cell contained its own mitochondria, but soon after the egg cell was penetrated by that sperm, the fertilized egg destroyed every last sperm mitochondria. Now, you may have heard of genetic researchers that have described tracing back all the mitochondrial DNA variants back to a single donor, the so-called Lucy, the mitochondrial Eve. Well, it may be time to rewrite some of the textbooks on this subject. Let me drop for a second. A team of researchers from the United States, China, and Taiwan identified three unrelated families with members whose mitochondria contained from both parents. While this discovery could ignite debate about the nature of inherited mitochondrial DNA, the researchers hope it will open up new ways to treat disease. The story begins when a 4-year-old patient suffering from fatigue and muscle pain was referred to a physician scientist by the name of Taosheng Hong at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. Now, others had suggested that the boy was showing signs of a mitochondrial disorder, so Huang sequenced and analyzed the boy's mitochondrial DNA and found an abnormally high level of what's called heteroplasmy, meaning different mitochondria seem to contain different genes. Mystified, he sequenced the mitochondrial DNA of the boy's other family members, including his sister, parents, grandparents, and siblings of his parents and grandparents, and it appeared that the boy had, as expected, received his strange mitochondria from his mother, who shared the high level of heteroplasmy. But further analysis revealed that his mother, his grandfather, and two of his great aunts had inherited the mitochondrial DNA from both parents. Let me drop for a second. So Huang reached out to other labs looking for families with members who similarly had high levels of heteroplasmy. He found two others with very similar patterns, where certain individuals seemed to inherit mitochondrial DNA from both parents. Others would then pass on to children. And to further remove doubt, Huang enlisted the Baylor College of Medicine to take independent blood samples and sequence the three families' mitochondrial DNA on their own. And their results confirmed Huang. Those results are naturally provocative, as several other attempts to show mitochondrial DNA passed from both parents or from the father to the child have turned up negative. It's now unclear how male mitochondria would make it into the egg, since the egg destroys the sperm's mitochondria after fertilization. But the new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences proposes that perhaps, just perhaps, a mutation turns off the egg's mitochondrion elimination ability. This study likely doesn't have huge implications on evolutionary timescales, where maternal inheritance remains almost absolutely dominant. The author's right, it's an exception to a rule. But Huang was more interested in what the results would mean for treating disease. We drop for a second. You may be familiar with another project in which researchers produced a baby from three parents. An egg from a donor, the nucleus from a mother, and a sperm from a father. This was to prevent the mother from passing along a mitochondrial gene-based disease called Lee syndrome. It was a very complicated and very costly procedure. Now, perhaps, if they can find the mechanism by which to transfer the father's mitochondria instead of the mother's, they'd be able to offer these options without the three-parent procedure. So maybe, just maybe, Lucy be our mitochondrial Adam instead of mitochondrial Eve. And by the way, if you are interested in hearing about how these new genetic tests that are available to the public are finding lost relatives and showing that occasionally infants are actually switched at birth, I'm also putting up a little link to a video that demonstrates examples of all that, again, on roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. So I assume no one wants to really talk about mitochondrial genetics. That's okay. I'll move on to the next. Here is one that Paul was interested in last week, so I pushed it up on the priorities list. Material science discoveries have come up with some fascinating new materials. Researchers recently created a hydrogel that can carry repair cells for damaged areas. Two teams of researchers from the Research Institute in Lausanne, Switzerland, have created a material that can help heal damaged cartilages more effectively. When cartilage gets damaged, it needs all the extra help it can get. It doesn't heal itself like other soft tissues do, so any injury that involves one requires medical intervention. That's why scientists continue to look for better methods and materials to treat cartilage-related injuries. And one technique they came up with is injecting damaged areas with a hydrogel material loaded with either drugs or repair cells. The problem with the method is available commercial hydrogels don't stay put when your patients move. Doctors need to use membranes to keep them in place, and those membranes have to be sewn onto the tissue, and the hydrogel is supposed to heal. The researcher's material, however, naturally sticks to soft tissue. Let me drop for a second. In fact, the new hydrogel that's 90% water and composed of a double network matrix and a fiber network adheres to tissues even more when it's compressed or stretched. This is because of a double network structure that distributes incoming mechanical energy throughout the hydrogel. If you load the material with repair cells or drugs, it can heal broken cartilage without the need to damage them further with sutures. Researchers claim that their hydrogel is 10 times more adhesive than currently available bioadhesives on the market, and thanks to its high water content, these new hydrogels are very similar in nature to the natural tissue it's designed to heal. So the researchers have already proven that the hydrogel can adhere to several types of tissues. Going forward, they plan to load it with different agents typically used for treatment and to tailor it to specific applications. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GX.
GXM.
WS1.
Yes, first Rich and then Paul.
So Roy, how far out would these treatments be for general use? Are they available as treatments now? I know some people whose knees could benefit from this, WB2GXM.
Well, Rich, unfortunately, the wheels of science grind slowly, and especially when it comes to drugs, there's the FDA to deal with. They would have to fast-track this. You have to test it on a bunch of people and make sure that there's no nasty little side effects that you were unaware of, because if you don't, and in 5-10 years from now, something terrible happens to a bunch of people, the companies are out a couple billion dollars. So, unfortunately, unless the FDA decides to fast-track it, I would be incredibly surprised to see this material going into non-research environments in less than 5 years.
Thank you, Roy. GXM out.
Okay, over to you, Paul.
Okay, thanks for covering that. You know, that's one of the most common problems throughout America, is people with these knee problems. So I was going to ask Paul the same question, how far down the road are they ready to do this? But 5 years, even 5 years is good. You know, there's a little light to the end of the tunnel instead of going for these operations and sewing things together and, you know, not becoming a problem. You can stick something in there and it's going to stick there and stay there. That sounds like the way to go. Very good. Back to you, Rick.
Now, they won't get any little bump along the way, and they'll be able to progress down the general method that you need to go through the Food and Drug Administration and such. Cartilage is a very interesting tissue. If you take a slice of it, you look under a microscope, there are almost no cells around. It's very lonely in cartilage, and that's why the healing is so terribly poor, because there's other cells. If you do that to a bone, especially near the growth areas or the old growth areas, you see a lot of osteoclastic, osteoplastic action going on. A lot of cells dividing and doing all kinds of fun things. But cartilage is a relatively cell-poor tissue, and so it barely responds to trauma, unfortunately. It's a serious design flaw, one would say, but it's heck getting in touch with the guy who holds the warranty on it.
But I would help people in sports then when they do injuries that way as well. Not necessarily older people, but younger people as well, right?
Yes, Paul, this would be effective in all cartilage injuries, both age-related and trauma-related. So sports especially, trauma as in, you know, car accidents or what have you, or as we get older, we fall down, we go boom, and things break or tear or split and such. So, yeah, it's across the board. It would be a very, very useful additional tool for orthopedics.
So they're probably going to test this in animals and eventually try to convince the FDA to let them on a trial basis. That's the way it goes.
Yeah, that is the usual method. First you do on animal studies, and once you have all the research results available, you go to the FDA and they approve a limited human test subjects, and usually, especially if it's a pharmaceutical company paying the bills, you pay them a little bit of something to be a test subject, and you figure out how that goes. Then you expand the test subjects to a broader research level, and once you get enough positive numbers and very few to no negative numbers, you go back to the Food and Drug Administration and you plead pretty please three times, and they approve it.
Yeah, I wonder how many people are going to be going for knee surgery and then find out 5-10 years from now that they could have had this. And that makes you wonder if people will delay their operations, hoping to have some kind of light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, Paul, but it's a matter of 20/20 hindsight. If you can look in the crystal ball and find out that this particular procedure has no side effects, and you could have had it 5 years earlier, then you kind of annoy someone or pay someone off to have it. But the same way as there's a lot of procedures and medication that down the road we've figured out doesn't really work or can be detrimental. There was a very, very popular thing going on with arthroscopic surgery, where for all intents and purposes, they would just drill a hole, grab a bunch of tissue, move it around, irritate it a little bit, call it a day, and patch you up, and think that they were doing something. When they did a long-term statistical analysis, they found they were doing absolutely nothing. It was a placebo effect. Now they're injecting things like stem cells in it and trying to regain the value of these things. So you never quite know what will work in the end and what doesn't. Just because it sounds like a great idea doesn't necessarily mean it is a great idea.
Okay, very good. Very good explanation. And thanks for that, Roy. WS2N.
Okay, very good. Now, the Large Hadron Collider, the world's largest atom smasher, has been the focus for many of our stories here on the TechNet. But sadly, it will be turned off for the next 2 years for upgrades. But hopefully this particle hunting ability will be even better once it restarts in 2021. The LHC experiment is the crown jewel of CERN in Geneva, Switzerland. A complex of successive rings accelerates subatomic particles before injecting them into a pair of intersecting rings 16 miles around. At each intersection point, a detector acts as a camera to watch the results of the particles crashing together. Scientists use the experiments to discover the Higgs boson, a particle partially responsible for giving other particles mass. Its shutdown and upgrade will hopefully allow physicists to explore new, previously inaccessible frontiers of the universe. Let me drop for a second. Several parts of the Large Hadron Collider will receive upgrades during this two-year period, also called the Long Shutdown Number 2. The injectors that feed particles to the accelerator will be altered to accommodate stronger particle streams, according to its third release. The linear accelerator, the first steps of the accelerator process, will be replaced. Other accelerators along the way to the final Large Hadron Collider ring will receive upgrades. The electrical components, each of the collision measuring detectors will see upgrades. One of them, called the LHC-B, will be nearly replaced. But work will also continue on the upgrades that will turn the LHC into the HL-LHC, or the High Luminosity Large Hadron Collider. You may have heard some rumblings about how the Large Hadron Collider hasn't found any new particles since the Higgs boson. By now, many physicists were hoping to have seen evidence of supersymmetry, a list of partner particles for each existing particle that would help explain several outstanding physics problems at once, and could be a candidate for explaining that darn dark matter. But supersymmetry remains undiscovered. Let me drop for a second. Now physicists are trying to find new leads in other ways, by searching for rarer outcomes of particle collisions and deviations from the standard model of particle physics. The HL-LHC would increase the collision rate by 5 to 7 times, to make any abnormalities much more obvious. All of this renovation doesn't mean science will stop at the Large Hadron Collider. The detectors merely collect data, but it's up to scientists to dig through the data in order to find something new. Physicists are still sifting through the 2015 to 2018 run. The Large Hadron Collider is scheduled to restart in 2021, and the Large Hadron Collider hyperluminal project will begin in 2025. So let's hope there's no technical delays. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2.
US 20.
Paul, go ahead.
I wonder if I'm getting lower. You got a little lower. All right, very good, Roy. I wonder if they're going to use different material. You know, for instance, the Rick project out here in Brookhaven, they use gold protons. Are they going to change the material, whatever they use out there in CERN? Sounds like they're just trying to increase the volume, how many times, you know, something actually hits, you know, instead of, you know, a couple of shots. You want to do hundreds of shots at one time or whatever it might be. Is that the goal? Because I know they're up to the speed of light or close to the speed of light, so they can't be increasing the speed. Must be just going for volume. What do you think, Roy?
No, they're actually going in both directions. You know, when you say close to the speed of light, it's to kind of overuse a joke. It's all relative. It's how many tera electron volts of energy you've imparted onto these particles that allows you to further dissect particle nature of the universe. So they're increasing the efficiency and the capacity to speed up the particles more. They're going to be using phased array linear amplifiers, linear accelerators rather, to start the acceleration before it gets into the ring. They're also increasing the amount of sample that gets accelerated into the ring, so they're trying to improve both aspects simultaneously. The decision of what to put into the machine can be made after the repairs and modifications are done, but the modifications are primarily meant to improve both the acceleration and the amount that the device will tolerate.
I wonder if they're going to increase the magnetic field and all those magnets, hundreds and hundreds of magnets that go around that facility. That was a big deal. Remember, originally, I think one of them broke the protons or whatever it was, come flying through and destroyed a couple of those magnets. And it was a big deal just to change them out. I wonder if they're going to try to increase the magnetic field. Does that change?
From what I heard, they're not planning that. That would be a real major undertaking to rip out all of those superconducting magnets and replace them with something a little stronger. Yeah, during the initial test procedure, one of the superconductors failed. And unfortunately, that's not a quiet failure. When one of those things goes off, you're left with high-energy protons that no longer are being accelerated around in a circle that just kind of fly into things, and that leads to other problems. So, yeah, there was a problem with the design. There was a flaw. It wasn't structurally sound, and they went into it, and that took a bit of a delay, and they swapped it out. I haven't read really about any plans of increasing the total Tesla count of the superconducting magnets. They're looking at other technologies where they don't have to use that much more energy, but they'll get better, more efficient use of the power that they always have. A power generator could basically power a middle-sized city. They use a lot of power there.
Oh, okay. Well, very good. As long as they don't have to touch those things. And, yeah, that was a big deal. Okay, so they're just going to change the linear accelerator before it gets in there. Usually they go through another circular type of accelerator before they go into the big one. Sometimes they go into a series of those. I think that's what they had there. So, okay, so maybe they're increasing that capability. Very good. Yeah, I think you said 16 or 17 miles in diameter. That would be a lot of work to change those magnets. Okay, back to you, Roy. WS2.
Okay, very good. If anyone has any other questions, say it now, or I'll move on to probably the last topic for tonight for me, which is a discussion of new battery technology. There's always news about new batteries. So if anyone has any further questions before I move on to the next article. The audience has spoken by not speaking. It seems like every week there's a report of an exciting new breakthrough in battery technology, and this week hasn't been an exception. Researchers have announced a new battery breakthrough that focuses on the negative. Rather than using lithium, the most electropositive element on the periodic table, they would like to use fluoride, the most electronegative. It can store more energy than its lithium doppelganger. But until now, batteries need to run as hot as 150 degrees Celsius or more. Now, Honda, Caltech, and NASA scientists discovered a way to make it work at room temperatures, which could eventually yield more energy density and environmentally batteries for electronic vehicles and other devices. Fluoride ion batteries essentially work in the opposite direction of lithium ion cells, attracting electrons instead of shedding them. Fluoride, the ionized version of fluorine, is an interesting battery material because it has a very low atomic weight and a very high capacity to store electrons. However, you have to dissolve the fluoride ions into an electrolyte, and researchers have found that it only works with solid electrolytes to a very high temperature. Let me drop for a second. To get around that, the Honda NASA Caltech team created a liquid electrolyte called BTFE that allows fluoride to dissolve at room temperature. With two positively charged regions, it exploits the opposite attracts principle, reacting strongly to negatively charged fluoride. The scientists paired the electrolyte with copper, lanthanum, and fluorine to create a prototype battery capable of reversible chemical reactions. That's recharging to us guys. And at room temperature. All told, the batteries have a potential for 10 times the energy density of lithium-ion batteries and could be have more favorable environmental footprint, according to the people at Honda. However, we've heard of this sort of thing many times before, so the usual cautions and caveats apply. For instance, the team still has to figure out how to stabilize the anodes and the cathodes, which tend to dissolve completely into the electrolyte, which is not good. They're making some headway, and further testing is currently underway, so hopefully we won't be disappointed yet again by batteries that work great in the lab, but not terribly great in the cars. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Nothing on the battery technology. Dick, getting back to as long as we're talking about battery technology, you were talking about electronegativity of metals, and if you put two metals with a different electronegativity next to each other, they have a galvanic and they actually produce a current between the two and corrosion.
Google the word dissimilar metals. You get a great big long list of what is the electropotential of each of these metals, and the ones that are further apart on the on the list. When you put them together, you're going to get more and more galvanic action. Copper and steel are two of the ones that should, if at all possible, never be brought in contact with each other, because you're going to get a lot of grief. I can't think of the name of that list. Electronegative list, I guess what you call it. It's got another name. O-U-R-O-K-T-R-I-W.
Okay, I mean, I was taught electronegativity, and if you Google electronegativity charts, there are hundreds of illustrations of different materials, different electronegativity. If you find two that are very close to each other, they have a very minimal galvanic response. If you find two that are very different from each other, you have a massive galvanic response. And it's the basis for how batteries work. Batteries are basically chemical factories. They're oxidation reduction devices where the only thing that's, in the electrolyte, the ions are moving in one direction, but in the anode and the cathode, through a conductor, the electrons are moving in the opposite. And so it's purely a chemical reaction, but it's based fundamentally on the differing electronegativity of the cathode and the anode.
When you and I make the mistake of touching a charged circuit, the current flowing in the wire is electrons. Where it makes contact with your skin, from then on, what flows through your body are not electrons, but ions. You're still being electrocuted, but it's not the electrons that are flowing through your body. Another way of looking at it, nobody really.
Well, yeah, I mean, but one way or the other, you're getting the flow. You're getting the flow of electrons in one direction and the flow of ions in another, because all things have to come to an equilibrium and charges have to be balanced. So you're never going to get to a point. You can have electrostatic fields for a time, but over the long haul, all electrical charges dissipate and equalize.
Batteries, casing?
Sure. What's your battery question?
Now, if you have 12-volt lithium batteries, lithium-ion batteries, without the BMS install, I'm trying to get them for my camper, but there's like a model that's way cheaper than the ones that have the BMS installed. Going through an empty holder that handles lithiums, still need the BMS on there. Ones that are like way cheaper for just the lithium ion without the BMS, like 100 amp hours, there's only like 590. Then they have the battle born, like almost 1,000.
Well, I'm not a complete expert in batteries. I'm just a dilettante. The problem with maintaining batteries is cell balancing. Most batteries are made up of a package of cells hooked up in series, and sometimes series and parallel. And you need the proper amount of intelligence built into these cells to know how to do the cell balancing. If you happen to have batteries that have built-in cell balancing already, I guess you don't have to be that persnickety about the external control device, I'm sure that Dick has much more knowledge in this particular area.
Not necessarily. However, the batteries that are used for a very heavy service, the electrical-powered radio control model aircraft, almost all of those batteries have wires going to the individual cells. The elaborate charging network, which does an elaborate, very fast charge, looks at the individual cell voltages during the charging process and tries to keep everything balanced during the charging process. If they didn't do that, there would always be a charge, there would always be a cell that was undercharged, and that one would eventually give you a failure. So, the more respected batteries and chargers track of the amount of charge on each of the individual cells. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
Okay, so ultimately it really depends upon the manufacturer's recommendation, because I have these nice little things I play with. They're lithium, they're not lithium ion, they're lithium iron phosphate, slightly different chemistry, and they tend to have the cell balancing circuitry packed in with the individual cells and wrapped together. So it's all in one fell swoop, and all you need is a current limited power supply to charge them up. You don't need it to be terribly intelligent. If you've bought batteries that are not designed with built-in cell averaging balancing intelligence inside of them, yeah, you definitely need a charger that supplies it from the outside. So always kind of interact with the manufacturer and see what their recommendations are, because they're not always just trying to make a buck. They're sometimes trying to make your experience better with the product.
They're recommended for deep solar applications, like not the BMS. But when I asked him about the BMS installed, he was like, well, we can do that for you if you want. But he didn't, like, tell me that I needed it. And I said, well, if you want it, we can put it on there. But he didn't quite give me that I really want it. So I needed donor lettering.
Repeater, timeout.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are different technologies for charger. There are constant current chargers. There are constant voltage chargers. There are chargers that change the charge rate depending upon different factors. I would tend to assume, and I might be totally wrong, that it already has built-in cell balancing as part of its design. So when you told the guy that you wanted a cell balancing power supply in addition to the one in the battery, it was sort of like going to a tailor and saying that you would like belts and suspenders, which is a look, a little bit redundant, but it's a look. So that would be my guess of what might be going on, but I couldn't tell you for sure.
Okay, I'll bounce it off of him again. Thanks very much for your help in the net.
Okay, very good. I want to thank Dick and Paul for the opportunity of doing this every Sunday night, and I just want to repeat for the people out there that if they have any topics or subjects, or they want to ask questions, or they want to answer questions, or they want to refute my answers, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to see any of the YouTube videos or any of the articles that I cite, that's on a website, then just point your browser to roy.ac2gs.com and the links will magically appear. And if you're so inclined, we do maintain a chat room. I was having a conversation with a guy earlier this evening about some aspects of physics, and if you log on, you could probably see the script between the two of us and maybe learn something. And you can get there by just typing chat.ac2test.com into your browser as well. So I want to thank you all, and give it over to Paul for the space report.
That's very good. This is WS2N for the space report. And Roy, I did send that Christmas story over to you, so post that, and always let people know that if they want to see the minute 14, well, it was actually 14 minutes long, but on the 60-minute show, it's on that website, if you're able to post that. It's a long URL.
The beauty of things is I can cut and paste, and no one has to see the long URL. They just have to click the text that says 60-minute show discussing CRISPR, which is going to show up on the webpage as soon as the TechNet is over. I tend to not do it earlier because occasionally I give an extra article, so I don't want to kind of double my work. So as soon as the TechNet is over, that website will have both the low-intensity sounds of Martian winds and the link to the 60-minute show discussing CRISPR.
Very well done. Very good. Thanks, Roy. Okay, talking about Inside Lander. I have a lot of new pictures coming back from that mission. That's the one that launched last May and wound up on Mars near the equator last week. And that's the one with the seismometer on board, and it's got the AG3 that's the sensing unit that's going to go dig out 15 feet into the ground, and it's all going to take many months before it's both set up and accomplished on Mars. They don't really take their time. They don't want to make any mistakes. There's nobody up there to fix it if something goes wrong. But yeah, I want to get back to the sound on Mars. I'll get back to that a little bit later. We'll cover these other topics first. Yesterday, I stayed up last night to see a launch. It wasn't a NASA launch, so they didn't have it on TV. I found it on YouTube, live YouTube. Mission launched out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. Wound up not going. It was scrubbed. It was a Delta IV Heavy. What NASA uses, or United States, what we were the heaviest launch vehicle that we make. It's not as powerful as the Saturn. Falcon 9 Heavy, Elon Musk and SpaceX came up with, but it's been around for many, many years. Got the three Delta IV boosters bolted together. They collectively develop around 1.7 million pounds of thrust. Supposed to take off 11:06 last night. Blade the day before, so this is the second scrub. So supposed to actually go off at 11:16 last night. Level on the previous night, and sure enough, the thing was scrubbed right at the last. It actually went past zero, minus zero, and then all the flames coming up and everything, but then he shut it down. Apparently, they have a problem, and they did not give a date for that launch. But what they wanted to launch was a government satellite and NRO, a National Reconnaissance Orbit. National Reconnaissance Rocket. They call it the NROL. This was number 71. Actually, it's all supposed to be top secret, but information leaks out. Apparently, it's some kind of telescope that's going to be looked down. It's launched from Vandenberg, most likely on a polar orbit. My guess is probably going to be a very high inclination orbit. Now and then, they're going to be over at location on Earth, and they want real close pictures of the camera by satellite. Apparently, that one's now going to be. The big rocket has got these RS-62 engines on them, and liquid oxygen, similar to what Space Shuttle had. In fact, the engines are similar design, plus the RS-25 shuttle engines, but RS-62A, they don't have to be because they were not reusable. Are not even reusable. They burn up the Atlantic and go to the bottom of the ocean in the Pacific orbital zodiac. Same rockets that earlier in the year launched the Parker spacecraft to the sun, which was very successful and already made its first pass near the sun. That was a successful launch of a Delta IV. Now what happened was a launch out of Cape Canaveral. Electron rocket. Now it's a rocket that's being launched almost on a regular basis out of